Please turn with me in your Bibles to Psalms 84. Psalms 84. I'll be reading verses 1 through 4. How lovely is your dwelling place, O Lord Almighty. My soul yearns, even faints, for the courts of the Lord. My heart and my flesh cry out for the living God. Even the sparrow has found a home, and the swallow a nest for herself, where she may have her young, a place near your altar. O Lord Almighty, my King and my God, blessed are those who dwell in your house. They are ever praising you.
Well, good to see everybody here today. I know that a number of our members are out of town because of the holiday this last week, and we want to pray for them and make sure that they get home safe and sound. So check on anybody, just if there's anything concerning, if you have not seen someone in a while, or if you've not been in touch with someone who has been staying home and using the live stream, let's make sure we check on each other. Let's know what's going on in each other's lives, and that there's not some spiritual concern in anybody's lives. I'm very encouraged by your presence here today, though. It's a gloomy day, but it's a joyful experience to be in the presence of God and His people. Have your Bibles open to John chapter 2. We're going to take a look at a story here in John chapter 2, and we'll begin reading in verse 13. Follow along, if you will, in John chapter 2, beginning in verse 13. Now, the Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. He found in the temple those who were selling oxen and sheep and doves and the money changers seated. And he made a scourge of cords and drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen. And he poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. Now to those who were selling the doves he said, "Take these things away. Stop making my Father's house a house of merchandise." His disciples remembered that it was written, "Zeal for thy house will consume me." The Jews therefore answered and said to him, "What sign do you show us, seeing that you do these things?" Jesus answered and said, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." Now the Jews therefore said, "It took 46 years to build this temple, and you're going to raise it up in 3 days?" But he was speaking of the temple of his body. Verse 22. When therefore he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this, and they believed the scriptures and the word which Jesus had spoken. So this is the first time that Jesus comes and cleanses the temple. We're going to make a note later on in our lesson of the fact that he comes a second time, a couple years later, to cleanse the temple again. And we'll discuss that when we get to that point in the lesson. Let's take a look at a few details here in John chapter 2 as we get going. There's a phrase that's used here, a house of merchandise. Take these things away and stop making my Father's house a house of merchandise. The place where God's people were supposed to come and draw near unto Him, the place where they were supposed to bring a somber spirit of repentance to receive forgiveness for their sins, the place where they would bring a sacrifice, and the sweet smell and the aroma of that sacrifice would remind them of the forgiveness that they find alone in their God, the God of their fathers. That place was now a place of noise, of chaos, of arguing and bargaining, of filth and greed, of animal waste and stink. And where has that reverence gone? Where's the sense of awe and the sense of wonder that you could see in Psalm 84, verses 1 through 4, which was just read a few moments ago as our scripture reading? Where did that sense of awe go where the writer of Psalm 84 could say, "I am envious of the birds that get to rest up in the eaves of the temple because they get to be in the temple all the time"? Oh, that I could be in the temple of God like the birds resting up in its eaves. I would rather be outside the temple, exposed to the elements, than to be in a comfortable place with God's enemies. Oh, how wonderful it is to be in the household of God. Now, just imagine what it would be like. And I understand this is not a direct parallel. A church building in the 21st century is not a direct parallel to the temple in Jerusalem. Let's be careful that we don't get that mixed up. Because I think sometimes, maybe in a subtle way, we do. This building is not the temple of God. God's people are the temple of God. So I understand it's not a direct parallel, but let's just imagine, just for the sake of imagination, because I don't have to look for a reason to share my imagination with you, but imagine what it was like if this was the East Shelby Church of Christ and Stockyard. And that was on our sign out front, the East Shelby Church of Christ and Stockyard. And along with worshiping God in this facility, we had livestock, live animals kind of milling about and wandering around. And we had a place where we kept the manure in the back over there, and the feed was in a big trough up here. And while we were trying to worship God, all you could hear was like donkeys in the background, yee-haw! While we were that's right. I am also the first preacher that has ever yee-hawed from the pulpit. There's a, you know, in the 2 years you've known me, there have been a lot of firsts that we've shared together. But imagine what it would be like if a place, a facility that was meant to be a place of reverence and awe, of worship and praise and fellowship, also was being used to house livestock. And then you can start to understand a little bit why Jesus was so angry when he came into the temple. Jesus' extreme response is entirely justified. As is noted here in John chapter 2, Psalm 69 would predict and prophesy that the Messiah would have an unparalleled zeal for God's house. And because of that zeal, he couldn't help but drive out the elements that made a mockery of the worship that was supposed to be taking place in the temple. And such measures were expected of the Messiah. The Messiah is a purifier. The Messiah is a refiner. The Messiah doesn't let you get away with laziness. And the Messiah doesn't let you get away with turning the house of God into a house of merchandise. Now, most people had come to accept the money changers as an unfortunate reality. I don't think anybody liked the fact that there was a lot of livestock out there in front of the temple. I don't think anybody felt like that was how it should have been, but they came to accept it as a reality. It is what it is. You go to the temple, we got a big festival going on, it's the Passover, you got sheep out here and goats over there and doves being sold over there for the poor people that can't afford the sheep and the goats. And people just had sort of accepted it as a reality. Maybe here's a quick practical application. And again, I want to reiterate, I'm not drawing a direct comparison between the temple in Jerusalem and its purpose and a church building in the 21st century and its purpose. But I do wonder sometimes if we sort of get used to things not being quite perfect. We get used to things not being quite right. We get used to, like, distractions. We get used to the misuse of things. I fear sometimes that, you know, we may look at our own congregation and we go, well, you know, that's not perfect, or that's not right, or that's not the way it should be, or I wish it was different. But we just get so used to it that we don't have the will to change anything. And whether it's how we interact with each other, whether it's the level of charity or the level of hospitality that we practice, whether it's some program in our congregation that maybe just doesn't work quite right, or maybe it's just some role that I have in the congregation where I've just been sitting on talents for a long time, not using them. Or I'm just okay kind of sitting in the background, not really being involved or not being more engaged with things. And we just sort of, you know, we know that it's a problem. We know we could be doing better. But we just get so used to it that we just don't have the will to change it any longer. And I kind of think that's what happened. I mean, if you asked the average citizen of Jerusalem, do you think, hey, average citizen, just a quick question for you, for my YouTube channel, you know, whatever, putting it in 21st century terms. Does it seem respectful to God to have livestock milling about the courtyards of the temple. I think the average citizen of Jerusalem would probably say, I've always had a weird feeling. It just feels uncomfortable. It just doesn't seem right. But you're not doing anything about it. I think we just get used to that sort of thing. And I believe they got used to it as well. That exploitation, abuse, greed, formality, empty religion, those things had just become the norm. And while Jesus seems very extreme in his response, it certainly did leave an impression on the people who witnessed his actions. And we too shouldn't be afraid of taking extreme measures to fight sin or the influence of the world. It was Jesus himself who actually prescribed some pretty extreme measures. Things much more extreme than whipping money changers out of the temple. Things like chopping your right hand off if it's keeping you from heaven, or cutting your right eye out if it's keeping you from being in the kingdom. So Jesus was no stranger to prescribing some fairly extreme things. Are you willing to be an extreme person for the sake of God? And by the way, that doesn't need to be on a t-shirt or a bumper sticker or something, right? But are you willing to be a fairly extreme person for the sake of God? That if there was something that was keeping you from worshiping the way you should worship, would you take extreme measures to rectify it? If you were living an immoral life, would you take extreme measures to fight sin? If you were not being an effective Christian and being a witness for the gospel to your friends and coworkers and neighbors, are you finally willing to be extreme to make a difference in their lives and teach them the gospel? I just think, would we look at Jesus if we were in this situation, and would we be the people in John chapter 2 a little bit horrified by how zealous Jesus seems to be? Making a whip and kicking people out of the temple and knocking tables over and just making a big mess? Would we be the people kind of in the background of the temple going, I don't know about this Jesus guy. He's a little extreme for me. And yet he had so much zeal for God, his Father, and his Father's household, that he's willing to whip people and knock tables over to do the right thing. Now, what's interesting is when they confront him about this big act, this big event, this rather extreme expression of his zeal for God's household, when they confront him, the temple leadership doesn't tell him that he's done anything wrong per se. You notice here in the text that they don't confront him as if you shouldn't be doing this. They only confront him to ask for confirmation of what gives him the authority to do this. It's kind of a squirrely way, right? Maybe out of fear, maybe they fear the multitudes, maybe in some less than subtle way, they know that they've been contributing to a problem this whole time. And so they don't chide Jesus for what he does. They simply ask him, so by what authority do you do these things? They just want to seek a sign to confirm his authority. What sign do you provide us seeing that you do these things, according to verse 18 there? They, of course, take his response so literally that the entire point of his sign is lost on them. He says to them in verse 19, destroy this temple and in 3 days I will raise it up. Now, let's be gentle on them, okay? Because at this point, even his own closest disciples don't really understand what he's saying. So, don't be too hard on them here. I know it's easy for us in hindsight to go, clearly he's talking about the resurrection. Like, duh. I mean, 3 days, raise this up, clearly talking about the resurrection. So let's go a little bit easy on them here. But at the same time, has Jesus not given at least some indication that there's something more going on here than just building a temple? There's something deeper happening. He's giving an indication that it's not really about the temple as much as it's about the implications of him being the Messiah. The whole point of his sign was not to talk about the temple at all, but to look at the temple of his body and say, in me, embodied in me, Jesus of Nazareth, a human being with a human body, with flesh and blood and bones, in me is the embodiment of God. Or as Colossians 2 puts it, deity dwelling in a human body. And you can tear this body down. You can destroy this body. You can bury it in a tomb and seal it with a giant rock. And in 3 days, this body will be raised up again. This temple rebuilt. The temple was in an almost constant state of construction, as well as renovation. A little bit of background. Herod had decided to build this temple because, well, you know, King Herod the Great was a man who thought very highly of himself. He was known for his great construction works. He built theaters, and he built auditoriums and public buildings and sports arenas. And in Jerusalem, he thought it would be fitting to take that dirty old second temple that was built, you know, in the time of Ezra. Take that dirty old second temple and let's jazz it up a little bit. Now, they point out here that it took 46 years to build the temple, but that's kind of inaccurate because the temple, like I said, was in an almost constant state of kind of being updated and renovated and added on to. And get this, it wasn't even until 64 AD that the temple was officially finished, where everything that they wanted to do to it, everything that was originally intended, every renovation, every bit of upkeep, it was not until 64 AD that the temple was officially finished. And wouldn't you have it? 6 years later, what ends up happening to that temple in 70 AD? It's destroyed by the Romans. Man, they barely got to break the thing in. It still had that new temple smell on the carpet. Now, that's me making light of something. That was a horrible tragedy in 70. I shouldn't make light of that. But with all that work, I think it must have come as quite a shock to them for Jesus to make this statement. You could destroy this temple and I'll raise it up in 3 days. It's not just that it took 46 years to build up to that point. It's that it wasn't even finished yet. It was 46 years and counting. And there was still so much. There was still 30 years left of work to be done on this thing before it was finished. And so it's rather preposterous, they think. Rather preposterous that Jesus could say this temple should be completed. It was a fantastic and unreasonable claim at best. A little bit of picture for you here. You can actually go to Jerusalem now and you can see the remnants of that second temple. And it was destroyed by the Romans in 70 AD, and in subsequent generations it had other things built on top of it. Now the Dome of the Rock, a mosque, is sitting on top of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem now. But there's a spot where you can see some of the original stones that would have been used in the foundation of the second temple, the temple that was then added on to and expanded by King Herod the Great. And you just get an idea of how big these stones are. The reason I put the picture up is just to show, here's Jesus saying, you could destroy this temple and in 3 days I'll build it back up. But you can see how big those stones are. I mean, they're easily as big as this communion table right here, many of them even bigger. And Jesus is saying, in 3 days I can take stones this big, stack them on top of each other, and rebuild this temple. So you understand why the temple leadership thought this was a pretty unreasonable, a pretty ridiculous claim that he was making here. But perhaps one of the reasons that the temple leadership was so upset was the fact that Jesus was taking their greatest feat, their greatest accomplishment, and minimizing it. I mean, that's essentially what he's doing, isn't it? He's minimizing and trivializing. He's saying, this temple that took 46 years to build and counting and has 30 more years of work left to it, with stones that are the size of that table, that's taken hundreds, if not thousands, of people's work and thousands upon thousands of man hours of labor, and your greatest accomplishment, your greatest feat, your greatest trophy I could build it in 3 days. You ever get frustrated with people who do the same thing to you? Now, maybe you're not a marathoner, right? Maybe you're not Jacob Reeves, or to a lesser extent, Ryan Goodwin. I always make sure I keep Jacob Reeves, where, you know, up there where he belongs. But, you know, maybe you're not a really experienced runner or an athlete, and you got out there and you just decided, I'm going to run my very first 5K. I'm going to get out there. I'm going to do a couch to 5K training program. I want to take a little control of my health and my life, and I want to lose a little bit of weight. I'm going to run a 5K. Right, that's 3.125 miles. And for a lot of people, a little over 3 miles is a lot of miles if you've never run that much before. And you go out there and you do your very best and you run your first 5K and it takes you 45 minutes to do it. And then somebody comes along and says, oh, you ran your first 5K? 45 minutes? Well, that's awesome. Oh, I just did a 5K last weekend in 20 minutes. How does that make you feel? How does it make you feel when you're working on a project or you're doing your favorite hobby, right? Some of it just, you don't do it for money. You don't do it to be the best at it in the world. You just do it because you like doing it. And you're kind of good at it and you enjoy it. And someone comes and looks over your shoulder and says, oh, I wouldn't do it that way. But how does that make you feel? Now, Jesus is not saying this to make them feel bad. So let's be really clear about that. He's not saying this to gloat or to show off like, oh yeah, I can build a temple in 3 days. Watch what I can do. He's not saying it for that purpose, to be arrogant or gloaty or anything like that. But just imagine how they must have felt when they've got this grand edifice. They have this glorious tribute to man's ingenuity and Herod the Great's kindness and charity. And it's taken them decades and decades to do it. And Jesus comes along and says, you could tear it down and I could build it in 3 days, you know. And maybe that's one of the reasons why they were so mad at him, is because they felt like he was trivializing their greatest accomplishments. We can accomplish great things in life. And let's acknowledge that. We can run marathons and we can build bridges and we can build skyscrapers and we can make computers and cell phones and we can be software engineers and programmers and we can decode DNA and we can go to the moon and we can explore space and we can do some amazing things. But to all of our pride and arrogance, Jesus would say, tear that down and see what I can build in its place. Because what I can build in the place of man's arrogance will blow your mind. The greatest thing that can be accomplished in your life is nothing you can do for yourself. The greatest thing that can be accomplished in your life is not your career or something that you've built or some achievement that you've found. The greatest thing that can happen to your life is the grace of Jesus Christ coming into your life. And what He can build up in the place of human achievement is worthy of heaven. Because you don't get to take that skyscraper with you. And you don't get to take $1 million with you. And you don't get to take your Fabergé egg collection with you. None of that stuff comes with you. But grace comes with you. Seeking a sign. I think Jesus gets rather upset with them at the notion that He needs to give them a sign. Now, we see this reflected later on in the book of Matthew. Turn to Matthew and just notice a couple of references here, and then we'll move on from this point. In Matthew chapter 12 and in verse 38, notice what it says here in Matthew chapter 12 and verse 30. We'll go through verse 40 here. Now, some of the scribes and Pharisees answered Him, saying, Teacher, we want to see a sign from You. But He answered and said to them, an evil and adulterous generation craves for a sign. Yet no sign shall be given to them but the sign of Jonah the prophet. For just as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the sea monster, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth. Jesus echoes this statement again in chapter 16 and verse 1. The Pharisees and Sadducees came up and testing him, asked to show them a sign from heaven. But he answered and said to them, "When it is evening, you say it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning there will be a storm today, for the sky is red and threatening. Do you know how to discern the appearance of the sky, but you cannot discern the signs of the times? An evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, and a sign will not be given it except for the sign of Jonah." He's pointing them back over and over and over again to Jonah as a metaphor, a sign, a symbol for what's going to happen to the Son of Man. Just as Jonah was consumed by the fish and in his belly for 3 days and three nights, so shall the Son of Man be in the belly of the earth, buried in a tomb for 3 days and three nights. And understand, of course, please understand that the term 3 days and three nights is a Hebrew colloquialism. It's a saying that the Hebrews had that didn't always literally mean three full nights and three full days, but it was a colloquial term that they used to describe that span of time, give or take. And so here they are asking for a sign. "Well, give me a sign. Show me a sign. Show us a sign to prove your authority." And I think Jesus' response is, "Oh, you'll get a sign. You'll get a sign. And the sign shall be the empty tomb. When you come to that tomb on that first day of the week, and you see the rock rolled away, and the tomb empty, and there is no body there to be found, you'll see a sign, and that will be all the sign that you need." Now, the last question that I want to ask is this. In Matthew chapter 21, Mark chapter 11, and Luke chapter 19, we see Jesus come back to the temple around 3 years later. And he cleanses the temple again. Why do it twice? Now, some people reconcile this by saying that John's account is just out of order. Or maybe the synoptic accounts are just out of order. And they're referring to the same event, just not chronologically placed. Because John 2 is awfully early in the ministry of Jesus, and Matthew 21 and Mark 11 are awfully late in the ministry of Jesus. So some people just kind of reconcile it by saying, no, he only cleansed the temple once, and the writers just don't have it chronologically arranged. Now, there's some merit to that. Luke's account is the only one that explicitly states that his events are arranged chronologically. He points that out in the introduction in Luke chapter 1, that he's laid things out in chronological order, that you can see the sequence of events in the life of Jesus. So Matthew, Mark, and John, they never promise that what they're presenting is a chronologically arranged account of the ministry of Jesus. So it's possible that Jesus only cleansed the temple once, but I don't think so. I think based on the evidence that you see from John 2 and the way that it carries right into John chapter 3 without a break in the narrative, I do believe that John is referring to an earlier cleansing of the temple, and then 3 years later, Matthew, Mark, and Luke are referring to a second cleansing, which, of course, asks the question, why should he have to do it twice? Well, there's a few things to point out, okay? Some practical application. I think it's evidence of the little long-term impact of the work of Jesus during his ministry. That you can cleanse the temple, you can... I mean, it was a big event, wasn't it? I mean, it's not every day that a madman shows up with a whip and starts knocking tables over. Madman, with all due respect to Jesus, just from their perspective, you understand. And so it's a rather memorable thing that he does to come in and knock tables over and whip people. But then 3 years later, the same people, they've come back and they're just doing the same thing again. How sad that is. That we tend to go back to our old stomping grounds when it comes to the sins that we commit. I really don't believe in, and I know there are exceptions to this, so I'm not looking to be proven wrong with the exception, but I really do think that when it comes to sins, when you become an adult, you know, you're 20, 30, 40 years into life, you've pretty much committed, like, basically the sins that you're going to commit in life. And we don't tend to commit a lot of brand new sins as we go through life. We just tend to go back to a lot of the sins that we committed before. We tend to go back to the things over and over and over again. We keep going back to the same dirty water trough. We keep going back to the same old haunts, to the same kind of people, to the same kind of places, to the same kind of behaviors, to the same kind of activities. I have found that people who struggle with being a lukewarm Christian, that is almost always the sin that they kind of fall back into. People who struggle with lust, like with pornography or living a really licentious kind of lifestyle, that tends to be the sin that they go back to over and over and over again. People who are greedy, right, for a time maybe fight the greed back, but people who are greedy tend to go back to greed when they get back to sin. And I think you see the same thing here. Greedy, vain, materialistic, peddling, marketplace type people, they're going to come back. Jesus can whip them and knock their tables over and throw their money onto the ground and give them a couple years and they'll sneak back. They'll come back. Do you do the same thing? When the proverbial table knocking over happens in your life, when you get caught with the pornography, when you get caught with the lying, when you get caught with the whatever your sin is, someone comes in, knocks the tables over, whips you back into shape, and you go, I'm sure glad you did that. I needed that. I needed to be whipped back into shape. I needed to have a dose of sobriety thrown into my life. And I'm so glad, Christian brother or sister, my husband, my wife, my parents, I'm so glad, elders of the church, I'm so glad you came in and knocked the tables over and whipped some sense back into me. I needed that because I was on the brink of being lost completely in my sins. But then a few months later, do the same sins just come creeping back comfortably into your life? Maybe that's the reason why God showed twice cleansing the temple in Jerusalem. To just give us a reminder of our wayward lives. To just give us a reminder of how easy it is, even after being whipped into shape, how easy it is to just fall back into the same habits that plagued us before. We need to be scared of sin. Terrified of sin, terrified of the fact that it's out there, that Satan's creeping around looking for someone to devour, and he already knows what my weaknesses are. Jesus' claim that he would rebuild the temple was used at the end of his life as the basis for his execution. He points that out in Matthew chapter 26, verses 59 through 68. That it was because he made this seemingly blasphemous claim that you could tear the temple down and rebuild it in 3 days. It was because he said that, that the people rallied together and said, crucify him, crucify him. It was used as a source of mockery in the very next chapter, in Matthew chapter 27. You who said you could rebuild the temple in 3 days, why don't you go ahead and save yourself, rescue yourself? You think you're so powerful? You think you're such smart stuff that you can rebuild the temple in 3 days? What are you going to do about this? The irony, though, is that by crucifying Jesus, the chief priests and all of his enemies in Jerusalem were actually providing the very means for Jesus to show the sign of authority that they had been asking for. Show us a sign as to why you think you have the right to do these things. And it was those same people who had asked for a sign for Jesus' authority that killed him and gave him the opportunity to show that sign of his authority. May we have the same zeal for the house of God that Jesus did. May we have the same sturdiness and steadfastness in our faith. And may we be willing to stand up against sin in all of its forms, to buffet each other, to buffet our own bodies daily, as we fight the battle for our souls. If you're not a Christian here this morning, you really ought to be. Really, it's this afternoon. But if you want to become a Christian this afternoon, don't wait any longer. You have the opportunity to obey the gospel message if you just listen to what Jesus says. He who believes and is baptized shall be saved, according to Mark 16, verse 16. So whatever need you have, please let it be known by coming forward as we sing, stand and sing.